Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Poetry Salon Cast. I'm your host, Tricia Faye Hefner.
And I'm Kelly Grace Thomas.
On each episode, we interview one of our favorite poets to ask what got them started writing.
And what keeps them going.
And my favorite question, what do they do with a rough draft that wants to play rough?
Then we ask for advice that we, and you, our listeners, can use in our own writing practices.
Without further ado, welcome to this week's episode of the Poetry Salon Cast.
Hello, Kelly. Good morning.
Hi, Teresa. How are you?
I am in quarantine, so that encompasses a number of different adjectives about how I am right now. How are you handling quarantine? Like, when I think of you, I always think of you, like, in a car going around, being active out in the poetry community and, like, on a stage or talking with kids and teens and people about poetry. It's really weird to think of you as just being in the house.
Yeah, well, I think I'm doing similar things, but just behind a screen instead of traveling by car. You know, I think it's funny. There's two really different responses to quarantine. I think one is that we are going to use this time to settle and regroup and so maybe step away from some of the hecticness of schedules and overcommitting. And then there's the second camp. We're just going to fill our space just like we had before with Zoom readings. You know, I'm definitely in the second camp, but trying to visit the first camp every now and then when I can. So it's actually been kind of wonderful in terms of quarantine and how I have this gorgeous accessibility to the poetry world that I haven't had before. So my good friend Julia Kolchinski-Dasbach had her book launch last night and a reading from her new book, Don't Touch the Bones. And her and I are actually also hosting a reading series called Worlds Apart, Words Together, where I am hearing readings and co-hosting readings from some of my favorite poets around the world. So that has been really, really cool. So there's been a lot of learning curves and a lot of cool connections, which I wasn't anticipating, but I definitely miss restaurants. And I definitely miss wineries. I'm like leaning into nature, but very much missing the luxuries of life.
I totally feel you on that two different camps experience. On one hand, it's been very strange because, as you know, I am in Costa Rica, which means that I was getting away from all of the LA poetry scene or any poetry scene for that matter. And when this quarantine happened and everyone started putting stuff on Zoom, it suddenly became available to me again. So I actually went through this weird experience where I was starting to overschedule myself again. I'd like commit to being on like a poetry class and a poetry reading at the same time or just back to back. And like for the first time in months, I was feeling overwhelmed and overscheduled again. So now I've had to learn how to rebalance myself.
You know, I spent 5 weeks in Costa Rica traveling throughout the country, and I was with my best friend Lauren, and it was so hot she just stopped wearing pants.
Any of us wears clothes at all. This whole country should just be one large nudist colony. So anyways, writing here has actually been a little tricky. On one hand, it's like I certainly have plenty of free time for writing. During National Poetry Month, I wrote every single day, and I felt really good about that. But then after like a month of that, I'm a little burned out and I'm going like, what is poetry anyways? What are words? Is this real life? Fortunately, the Poetry Salon classes have started up again. So I'm getting some feedback from people and they're like, no, you're not crazy. This is good. Or you're not crazy. This is bad. You should cut this.
Community is so important when it comes to poetry. And I feel like you and I need to balance each other out because I feel like I've had no time to write, although I'm taking a poetry class. So I at least write one poem a week. I want more than enough time. I want to take a vacation and just write. That sounds so magical to me.
So, I mean, it's been like 100 years since we interviewed someone and since we've been getting all these great writing techniques. So I want to know what has stuck with you, but how has the writing been when you had time? Like, are you finding you're trying new things?
The writing has been great, actually. When I have time to come to it, I have taken a lot of the tips and techniques that we've learned from the other writers here. I have two different things I'm writing about now. One is my current struggle with infertility, which is really heavy and extremely heartbreaking. So to lighten that up, sometimes I tell myself I'm not going to write about it. I think as we do with any hard thing, which makes me think of the Victoria McCoy interview and how she talked about grief and how writing a letter to it. And I think the poem that I'll share later uses that technique. So I've been thinking a lot about that. Sometimes I get to the point with poetry where I just cannot write about myself. I can't take the first person anymore. I'm just so sick of it. So I've been really engaging in playful poems about animal facts. When things get too heavy, I go to the animals and I think about all of the cool things that will change your perspective if you go into if lobsters don't molt their shell, then they die. Magpies only live less than a day, so they never see the sunset. Or orangutans, 50% of them are walking around with broken bones because they all fall out of trees all the time.
Oh, man. Let's talk, actually, because as you're saying that, this reminds me a lot of the interview I did with Antoinette Brim, where she talks about finding obscure facts to use in her poetry. And I know you couldn't be there for that particular interview, but I remember one thing she said is she was trying to find a metaphor for love, and she went to the sea cucumber. And she talks about finding the right metaphor and looking at metaphors from nature, to talk about feelings and things like that. Let's just dive in and do a little review of the different poets that we have interviewed this last session. And I'm going to ask what stuck with you, what piece of advice has proven to be kind of useful or interesting. And then at the end, we're going to weigh in on whose advice helped us the most in this session. Sound good?
Wonderful. Yeah, I'm ready. That's great.
So our first interview was with Dorothy Chan. You're the one who brought her on board. So why don't you tell me a little bit about what stuck with you about that interview?
I think Dorothy is really sensational in dealing with the sensory, dealing with food and dealing with sex. There's something very primal about her poetry that I love. But at the same time, she is obsessed with the sonnet and obsessed with the form. So I love that her work has this juxtaposition of primal wildness or uncaged, however you want to put it. But then it's also being contained by a really tight, constrictive form. So I think that tension pushes against each other. And I really left thinking a lot about that and thinking about the sonnet and my relationship to sonnets and wanting to try a sonnet. And it's so funny because I've been starting to count lines of poems, and I counted Won't You Celebrate With Me by Lucille Clifton. And it was 14 lines in the turn at the end. And I was like, oh, snap, this is a sonnet. I'm now looking at things as sonnet, not sonnet. And I thought about even the weird animal facts. I thought about making those all sonnets just to see what it would be like to be constricted to certain lines and a turn. And I think that form can really inform the poet that's using it in a new way.
I think that's the reason I started writing poetry, actually, is I had this wild brain. And when I was studying Shakespearean sonnets sophomore year of high school, and I realized that there's a way to contain it all. It was just 14 lines. And I felt like that's where I first started understanding what a structure was. That just allowed me to feel like there was some boundaries, which I needed as a kid. I needed boundaries to contain my wild imagination, I've loved sonnets ever since. And what I love about Dorothy's sonnets is that she does the triple crown sonnet. So I love that idea of just playing with form and knowing that any kind of form that exists is something that you can futz with, create, recreate, combine, recombine. We're not restricted to just having these particular forms that we inherit, but we can actually take control over the forms and change them to suit our own needs. Maybe that's one of the things that I've taken away from her is that when I'm working with a form, a particular form, I don't feel so afraid of breaking it or trying something new because I know it can be a ghazal, but a Tricia ghazal where every other line uses the word squirrel in it. I don't know, you know, like I can make them my own like she does. Another thing that I really got from Dorothy Chan, I think I've been on like a little poetic journey right now because I tend to write a lot about nature. And right now, the only thing I'm really exposed to every day is nature. But some of my writing has kind of gotten very predictable. Like, what else can I say about nature and trees and monkeys and birds? So when we were interviewing Dorothy, I mean, all of her poetry is just so modern, and she has those great poems about the Jetsons. Like, she has poems about the Jetsons, and she has all these poems about pop culture. And unlike me, she really thinks a lot about where lines end. And for me, it's like the form of the poem is the last thing that I consider. So talking with her all those months ago really got me thinking about different ways that I can push my poetry, how I can start more from language, how I can think more about line breaks. And that just makes me look closer at my words. And I realized, oh, I've used the word ocean 800 times in this poem. So now I have to start looking for new words to use and new words to break on. And so that's made me consider going the thesaurus, but it's also made me consider like just changing my topic and including new words that I haven't used before so that my language and my line breaks are staying a little fresher. So I think that's been the biggest thing that I've taken away from her is every single word, it has to be doing some kind of heavy lifting.
I'm a huge fan of line breaks. For me, they make a poem so much more exciting because I think about each line as an individual entity. You know, where you break the line changes the entity of each line all together. So it's, I think they're very cool. So I'm so glad that you have a newfound appreciation.
I know I always poo-poo myself on line breaks because they're not the thing that comes naturally, but I will give myself credit. I am realizing like more and more I'm finding this is a good place to break the line. This is an interesting place. This is the fresh bit of language that I want to break the line on. So thank you, Dorothy Chan, on that. Next on up. Oh, next was Michelle Bidding.
Oh, yes.
I remember with Michelle Bidding, one of the things that she really talked about that was different for me was preparing the body for poetry. I know for me, I'm such an in-my-head kind of person that I'm usually looking at the words on the paper and going like, okay, what do the words mean? I never really think about my body as being the carrier of poetry and the vessel that feels the feelings. So what I remember her talking about the most was approaching the poem like an actor, where you have to get back into the emotional space of the poem in order to get back into like writing about it and doing your rewrite.
It's interesting that poems come to me all the time. You know, in fact, the poem that I used Victoria's advice on came to me at the gym. A lot of times it's when I'm in motion that the poem is like, wait, stop. I want to tell you something. I have the idea that my mind is really busy and it's really noisy. I have a theory that the poems are always there and that they follow me around like children. Mm-hmm. And they might be like, excuse me, but I'm usually too busy and I can't hear them. And it's when I'm moving because the mind is quiet, right? Your body is doing the thing so your mind can kind of rest. So I think that it's when the mind is quiet that the poems come to me.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about that too, because I think it's not just the physical movement of the body. It's also the fact that you're silent. If I go for a walk listening to a podcast, it is a very different experience from going for a walk listening to silence. And I think the poems are a lot more likely to come when you're listening to silence. And that's another piece of advice that was the best takeaway from me. I remember her saying that when she sits down to write, sometimes she doesn't think I'm going to write a poem or I'm going to write with any particular agenda, I'm just going to write and see where that leads. I can get very into product. And I'm working on several things. You know, I'm writing stuff for the Poetry Salon, and I'm writing a book about writing, and I'm writing my own poems and things. So sometimes I sit down with an agenda, and that agenda can really block me. But if I sit down and I'm just, okay, what's in my head? What's interesting to me right now? What do I want to say this moment? And I'm not going to have an agenda about it. Sometimes that will like immediately give me something, you know? Whereas if I sit down and I'm just like, I need to write that poem about my parents because it needs, the chapbook needs a poem about my parents. What can I say? It gets like very anal retentive. Whereas if I sit down and I'm just so like, I am sitting, there is a bird, I have no agenda, look at that cloud. You know, clouds remind me of, and then like something new will come up. And I think part of it is just because I am finally relaxed. And I think that's one of the big tricks in poetry, is just to like get your mind to relax instead of getting your mind to feel like it needs to create something.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that like as poets, we got to listen to the poem, right? If we relax, then the poem will tell us what it wants to be, but we got to like chill and listen and like not control it. And also like what the poem wants to be on Tuesday is not what it always wants to be on Wednesday. So I think it's good to give poems some breathing room.
I know it's just really hard sometimes to listen to silence, especially like with everything going on right now. Sometimes I'm just, please distract me. Please tell me a great story about a murder or something violent and horrible to distract me from like what I'm really thinking about. But yeah, when you actually do stop and listen to the silence, there are real gifts in there.
Sometimes I go on hikes for like 3 hours for the silence. I feel like there's so much noise in the world in general. And I'm sure that probably living in Costa Rica, you have a different relationship to the noise than I do. And it also depends on schedule. Like there's so much. There's a lot that can be revealed when you want to break the silence. And there's a lot that can be revealed when you want to lean into the silence. So listeners out there, examine your relationship with silence and then write a poem.
One of my poetry mentors, Kim Rosen, who wrote the book Saved by a Poem, she's been doing these silent retreats, even though they're via Zoom, where you all get together and she reads some poems and she kind of sets the tone. And then everyone at their home puts away their technology and agrees to be silent for 24 hours. And then after 24 hours, you come back and you check in again. And during that 24 hours, you're allowed to have like your journal and books of poems with you. So you can read poetry and write poetry. And otherwise you're supposed to just be diving into the silence. And it is such a challenge. After like 10 seconds, I'm just all like, I hate this. Why did I agree to this? Why can't I have a podcast? I can listen to a podcast. No one's going to find out. But I'm just like, no, I have to deal with that feeling and go through it instead of running away from it. So moving on, Antoinette Brim, that interview with Antoinette Brim, I thought was so useful. And I'm sorry that you didn't get to work with her, because I think you and she would have had a lot of things in common. Like you, she's also really interested in metaphor. She writes a lot about women. Her latest book is These Women You Gave Me, which is a line from the Bible where Adam basically blames everything that what goes wrong on the women that God gave him.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. I like to write about mythology sometimes, but I like to bring in biblical references. They're always so weighty, you know? There's always, yeah, like if I wanted to write about Mary Magdalene, it's not just that I have the story of Mary Magdalene. I also have all the ways that she's been portrayed for like 2,000 years. There can be a lot of pressure to do it right or to know everything or to consider everything that there is to consider. Sometimes when I try to write about biblical figures, it's like, I'm not God, and so I feel like there's going to be some thunderbolt that strikes me down if I say the wrong thing. I loved what Antoinette Brim said about You're just adding your voice to history. You're not necessarily putting yourself out there as being somebody who's more correct than everyone else, but you just have the bravery to say, like, this is my interpretation, my response to these ideas. This is how I interpret it. And knowing that you're just one of many voices and that that's okay. And I think that was so permission giving. It was fantastic.
I love the idea of pulling inspiration from these places and seeing, like, here's my hot take on it. I just love the way that we can be in conversation with a text, or that a text can start a conversation and propel you into, like, a completely different mindset or meditation on these topics. There's so much seeds everywhere, and I appreciate the world for that. So I love the idea of, like, taking something from science. I've really been thinking, as I said earlier, about animals lately, you know, and all they can teach us. There are so many things that were on this earth before us. You know, I read the other day that sharks were here before trees, and trees were way here before us. It's really world building, in my opinion. All of it is, right? And it's like looking at different perspectives and different walks of life and how you can walk through them in your poems. So,
and speaking of sharks, that was a perfect segue into our interview with Maria Elizabeth Molly, because I remember we are all three of us water babies. I remember her talking a lot about her relationships with sharks and marine life and being under the water and finding some of her inspiration there.
I was in a trance when she was talking, because there's so much that I can relate to, and so much of my work deals with the metaphor of water and the extended family of water and all that comes with it. So I really was just so in love with the way she was talking about poetry and how being under the water had informed her, how the watching, the observation, which is so much like what we do as poets, the same thing that divers do.
What I remember about talking with Maria Elizabeth Molly is her rewrite strategy is something that she talked about doing, something like a patchwork poem. So you take out the pieces of poems that are working from poems that are otherwise not working, and then putting them together and writing about, like, writing them together. And, you know, I tried that exercise. And what I wound up doing, I think, is I had, like, one line of a poem that was really good that came to me one day, like, just one line, but no other lines came with it. It came on its own. It was a line without a family. It was its orphaned line. And then I had this other poem that just wasn't going anywhere. So I just randomly tacked the orphan line to the end of it. And then I had to write, like, a whole other poem to mix the two of them together. I think that's just a super, super exercise, especially for those who are wanting to try something totally different and new with your writing. It's just randomly take the end line or beginning line of one poem and tack it onto another poem, and then write the middle poem, the middle part of it, so that one leads to the other, because you're going to have to generate some new interesting ideas.
Yeah, I agree. It's something that technique that I use and have used before, just because I'm such a chopper upper of my poems. And, you know, sometimes I'll write, like, a really shitty poem, like, horrible, but one line, I'm like, all right, you can stay. I don't think you can stay here, but you can definitely stay. So I love that advice that she gave us. I thought it was, I don't know. I think that sometimes poets can be a little precious with their draft. You know, not always, but especially if you don't write much. Like we were talking about before, forcing the poem what it's supposed to be. But if we just say, hey, I had to write that poem to get to that one line, and that one line is the end of this other poem, I think that's really great.
It just makes you think about things in a way that you wouldn't before. And I think that's part of what poetry is. And I think that's part of what writing poetry does. if you're not connected to your truth about something, then it means you're missing a piece, or you're like not looking at it from the right angle. And sometimes when you find that missing piece, you just experience this great click. It's like click, 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 all the things click into place. Next on up is Victoria Lynn McCoy. So again, someone that I know only through my connection to you. So what did you like about that interview?
Yeah, Trisha, will you ask me again? Because that broke up on my end. There's also the parrot is like, ee, ee. You think it's okay? We can just sit here.
Nothing I can do to stop him.
No, definitely not.
So I think it'll be okay. Just so you know, not that it matters, but that's actually not a parrot. I think that's a grackle. All the birds here are loud.
Hello, listeners. This is Trisha Faye Hefner and Kelly Grace Thomas of the Poetry Salon.
And as you know, we really love talking about poetry with our guests.
But one thing we love even more than that is sharing our poetry and our poetry community with all of you.
So if you're a poet who wants to get inspiration, education, and make friends with other writers, we invite you to become a member of the SalonCast on Patreon.
When you join this online group, you are going to get writing prompts and revision techniques sent directly to your inbox every week.
Plus, you get to see how Trisha and I use the revision techniques to revise our own messy, crazy, mediocre first drafts.
You don't write mediocre first drafts, Kelly.
Sure I do, Trisha. We all do.
And if you want to share your work, listeners, you can post it in our private Facebook group.
And you can give and receive positive, supportive feedback.
Best of all, once a month, Kelly and I will host a live poetry reading where you have to join us and read your poems out loud to us and the group.
It's like a 24-hour gym membership for your muse.
6 a.m. in the morning, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And best of all, it comes at just $9 a month.
So don't try to be perfect.
And as always, whoever writes the worst draft wins.
Victoria Lynn McCoy. Such a treasure of a poet. And again, she's one that I only know because you introduced me to her. So why don't you start us off? What do you remember from that interview? What did you take away that was most useful?
Oh man, all I remember is that, I mean, I remember so much, but all I think of is, you know, in the poetry community or the hip-hop community, they say bars when someone says something really profound. And, you know, I was just like, bars, bars, bars. She really processes stuff. She thinks really deeply about it. And whatever comes out of her mouth is always super sage and intentional, where I might just like, blah, 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 like whatever comes. You know? I remember her talking about her relationship with grief, thinking about the different ways that she can revisit the dead through different forms. I know she had a close friend that she lost. We also talked a lot about what are you afraid to say? What are you trying to say? And the one thing that I really took away from her is her use of the epistolary form and how much if you can direct a poem to be a certain speaker talking to another specific person, how that can really guide the poem. I mean, if I even start just saying, dear mom, or dear Starbucks caramel frappuccino, like I think that the epistolary form is really amazing. And I think I know a bunch of friends who have been writing in that form lately, and they talk about the flow of it. I was really engaged and actually, you know, wrote a poem with that form, and I'll share the poem later. What about you?
It's so funny. I love the discussion of the epistolary form because I'm working on an e-course called How to Think Like a Poet, and I have a whole section in there about point of view. Who are we writing to, and why are we sharing this writing? And do you write directly to the reader? Do you write to a specific person? And it's just a topic that to me is endlessly fascinating. Why do we write to the dead? I understand about writing to someone who's far away because you can hope that they're going to read it, or, you know, that they're going to, in a roundabout way, see it. But, you know, writing to the dead when they're not, at least logically, they're not going to read that. And yet it can be so cathartic for you, the speaker, to say something. There's just something in there that's so mystical and metaphysical and psychologically profound. The thing that I took away from her, though, was she talked about her poem First Catch, and it was about catching this fish, and she had written the poem, but she didn't really know how to begin the poem until she realized part of the problem with that poem was that killing this fish, catching and then killing this fish, she was good at it. And then she didn't want to admit that she was good at it. She didn't want to admit that she could potentially kill something. And when she got to the point of being able to admit this thing that she's afraid of admitting, that's what allowed her to finish the poem. I'm a student of psychology, and I know that whatever you dislike about other people is probably a projection of something you dislike about yourself. And I feel like poetry is just one of those things that you're not necessarily a psychologist if you're a poet, but you are also kind of a psychologist if you're a poet. You're always investigating your own emotions and where they come from and how you describe them and how you can relate them to the world. So I was just so fascinated by that. And I'm looking at that with all of my poems now. It's like, what do I not want to admit? What do I secretly want to do, but I'm always afraid of doing it? I think that has to do too with trying to write in a way that's fresher and different too. Like, what have I not explored? Why have I not explored that? It's opening new doors and giving me access to new territories. And some of them are like really easy now that I'm exploring them, and other things are just still really challenging. I still don't want to write about trash cans.
I've written a poem about a drain.
What? Tell me about that.
It was a workshop with Tim Green. I was at the Rattle Wrightwood. Tim Green, one of his ways that he begins writing is that he'll take an image, like a Google search image, and just look at it and write from that image. And I got a drain. So I was like, okay. I wrote about how drains swallow everything we don't want, and we never say thank you. And it's not until they like refuse to keep swallowing that we finally pay attention to their function. But you never think about it. Everything you pour down the drain up until that moment.
Yes. Oh my God, just the way you're talking about this, I'm thinking about like every oppressed person or person who's been taken advantage of, like swallowing all this stuff, and you only notice them when they stop swallowing it. That is a really friggin' good metaphor.
It's funny. But this is why it's good to write poems about, you know, about all sorts of stuff. Like you said, it's really the examination of emotion. But I think that that's what Victoria's interview is saying, that you need to really look at it and look at what is the emotion around it. And what is the fear? Like, what is the love and what is the fear? And those two things are what drive us. So I think that that should be the base of every poetry prompt, at least for me, is like, what are you afraid of, or why do you love it?
That could be a year-long workshop writing about the things that scare you and like just diving deeper into your fears and exploring them. You would never end your capacity for new writing prompts and new material that way. And I remember, I think after our interview, she told us this was the first time she had ever been interviewed before. And you're right, like everything she said was just like carrying this grain of wisdom, bars, bars, bars. Thank you, Victoria Lynn McCoy. So next on Up was our interview with Arthur Kazakian. Speaking of writing new things, I love talking with Arthur about poetry because he's like the poet's poet. He just has studied a lot of it with a lot of different writers, and he's so enthusiastic about doing new things with poetry, but also sharing that with other people. And I'm in a class with him now, and his enthusiasm for teaching new things is just off the charts. I love working with Arthur. I love listening to him talk about poetry. He loves it so much, and it's just so infectious. I think what was most interesting is when we got off topic, and he started talking about letting language lead in your poem I told you I took all these lines from some of your poems that you were working on, and I was trying to imitate Kelly Grace Thomas in my writing and just kept coming up with these lines from poems that you were sharing with me. Do you want to hear some of them?
Yeah, that would be great.
I took out some of the lines that I liked the most, and then I just responded with lines that either were imitating in some way or some way responding. So one of your lines was, in fact, do you want to do this? I just sent you the document. Do you want to read the line and then I'll tell you my response?
Sure. I'm like recognizing my lines. They're all bolded, right? Is that?
Yeah, they're the ones in bold. Don't you know your own children, yes. Kelly?
So the first one is, I want to grow something so soft you'd swear it was snow.
And I wrote, I want to know what is quieter than snow.
I hear the sea choking on our greed.
Do you hear the sun sewing dresses for the trees?
Browning prayers plotted in thirsty fields.
Our hunger ripening on every tree.
How easy dying feels.
How breezy the lying fields.
Sleep grows like a sickness.
My language slickens, slippery as an eel.
Hear her wither behind my dead bolts.
Feel them sweat inside my dead boots.
I ask forgiveness from 100 tiny pains.
I pray forgiveness from every cracking need.
The world keeps remaking itself without me.
And once I got to that line, I was like, I just want to write a poem responding to that line or that starts with that line. I don't think it's done yet, but it was so fun and invigorating to try to imitate your writing because you do so many cool, interesting things with language. So you saw that some of the things that I tried were like imitating the idea, what is quieter than snow, but in other ways it was just trying to imitate the sounds, you know, like instead of dead bolts, I said dead boots. That was really fun. And I've been doing that more with other poets. You know, there's a difference between the poets that you like and the poets that you are like.
Yeah.
So I've been looking at the poets that I like, but am different from and trying to imitate them more and consciously understand what I like about their language and how I can borrow, bribe, steal, and copy them. When we were talking with Dorothy Chan, like I realized how I wanted to try new things with my language and write about new topics. You know, I still write a lot about nature, but trying to explore some other things too. Kind of ending the session, ending the season with Arthur, who talks about using language in such a new way. It really just affirmed, confirmed, helped bolster that mission that I've been on to freshen things up more.
I love it. That's so amazing. I agree. I was really, really interested in how Arthur looked at different poets to re-examine his approach to language. I think of him as a seamstress who's like snipping this and tucking that and kind of like looking at the shape of something and how different fabrics can inform you and different cuts. I also liked the perspective of trying on different approaches, different voices. He was talking about writing from the perspective of a woman, which I found really fascinating. I sometimes have a little apprehension about writing from the perspective of a different person who's not a white, you know, in her 30s, females. I honor the bravery in that. For some reason, sometimes I'm just a little shy around that because of how it can be taken by other people. But I love, love, love the perspective of writing from a point of view like a squirrel or a seagull or the drain. While it can be a little sticky, I think it's so important to take on different voices. And I wrote a poem in the point of view of the planet Jupiter and how Jupiter felt, you know, and that was so much fun. So I really just kind of took away not only like to play with language, but also to really examine what are the perspectives that have gone unexplored.
And I think that kind of relates back to what we were talking about with Antoinette Brim, too. I mean, when you are writing about the perspective of someone who's not you, and let's be frank about it, even if you're writing from the perspective of someone who is you,
yeah.
you know, putting poetry out there, you are putting out ideas that can be unpopular, and you can expose yourself as saying something that is going to offend people, even, you know, whether you're doing it intentionally or unintentionally. I haven't been scared to write or publish for a long time, but now I remember why it is some people are afraid of writing sometimes, because you are saying something that might expose you to ridicule or some kind of blowback. You know, I think you used the right word, bravery. Like, there's a lot of bravery to even try that.
I think it's important to explore, and I also think it's important to ask about the responsibility of what you do with that exploration. There's books written about this. But I think just the idea of trying on perspectives of, you know, a tree or a baby shark or whatever it would be, it'll bring me new language. And I think that that's what Arthur was really opening the door to, is how we can find new language.
It really does come down also to, yes, your intentions, and are you taking responsibility? And like for me, you know, I teach one of these in the point of view classes, but I intentionally ask people to try writing from like a different gender, different age, something really different from you. Try thinking of someone you disagree with completely and try writing from their perspective. But one of the things I'm always encouraging people to do is, you really need to think about their perspective. Like, you can't go and use this as, hey, I'm going to use your voice to mock you. Right. You have to really investigate what they have said and think about it and give them the benefit of the doubt. That can be such a useful tool for people having a dialogue and understanding one another when it's done well. I mean, it's like language is neutral. It's a knife. You can use it to cut bread and feed someone. You can use it to slit someone's throat and destroy them. So it's all about how it's used, and are you using it in a way that's kind and responsible and genuinely trying to explore and understand and uplift the voices of others, or are you using their own voice to condemn them?
Exactly. And that's all I think that people are really asking for, is that we're responsible with what we put out into the world. And, you know, you can put out in the world whatever you want. You're also responsible for the backlash.
Yeah.
That's with anything. That's with a poem about your parents. That's with, you know, it doesn't really only have to be about gender or race or whatever. Right.
So now is the time where we get to ask, what of all the interviews and all the pieces of advice we gathered this session, what was the most useful for you?
For me, it was definitely Victoria Lynn McCoy's talking about the idea of, what are you afraid to say? Why aren't you saying it? And what is a form that you can use to say that thing more easily? You know, as I said before, the epistolary form really changed my approach to some things, and it helped me write a poem about something I felt like I had been struggling with.
That's pretty perfect, because I also chose Victoria Lynn McCoy. She gets the grand gold prize of poetry this session. And yeah, it was also, for me, it was less about the form. It was more about, what are you afraid to admit and say? It just occurs to me, like, do you want to go ahead and read your poem so I know what I'm talking about?
Sure, yeah. So this is a poem. I think my book, Boat Burned, examines a lot of my relationship with my body and bodies in general. And I was ready to make some kind of healing or apology or approach to the body. And I thought, what if I write a letter? How I learned you. Body, I still have high school on my hands. Counted each timid teaspoon of survival all those hours I stared at your windows, addicted to glass. Didn't know if I was the bird or the break. Body, I spent two summers burning you like boat. Still, I spread eviction like lip gloss. I can't write you out of me. Sadness turned me a duller instrument. The tourniquet of a turned back, my submission, these hands will always shake. My mother never taught me potassium or hunger. Instead, blurred speech mumbled what men might do, how we would empty each other body. There's no such thing as shelter. I don't live here. Neither do you.
Mm-hmm. All right. I am going to read mine next. Hour of the Butterfly, with some thanks to Audrey Rich. You're asking if I'm lazy. All right, I'm lazy then. Lazy as this volcano, loving the lava into the island. Lazy as the mangrove forest dropping its branches lazily into the heat, watching them lazily turn into the roots of trees. Lazy as a piece of sand the oyster is trying to mother. Like the earth, my job is holding still, letting the sun and rain open their purses for me, pulling ferns and frangipani ginger out of their seeds, spreading a grand parade of laziness over the island, lazily blessing the land with green and tangled things. Inside the chrysalis, this darkness lazily hypothesizes the color yellow, turning itself to insect, complicated geometry of antenna. I wish I could explain how this miracle happens, but I have been sworn to wordlessness, exhausted by the opening of its enormous wings. Okay, so why don't you talk about your poem and how Victoria Lynn McCoy's advice helped?
So I really loved the idea that Victoria had to think about what is the thing you're afraid to say and how can you start with that. And I think that the beginning of this poem starts with body, I still have high school on my hands, meaning that I don't know if I'm any more healed than the sad girl I was back in high school. So I love that approach. And I love the approach of speaking directly. And I think that when you take something like this and you speak about what you're scared of, it opens up this dialogue. It's not only the epistolary form where I could speak to what needed to be addressed directly, but that it was the beginning of a dialogue around the grief one might feel of not accepting their own body and how to begin to heal it. So I just really loved the advice that she gave and how I could apply that in a way that didn't feel like I was jumping into a cold shower.
Yeah, and I noticed you used the epistolary form too, the dear body.
Yeah.
For me, and I think it's so funny that you and I chose the same thing, and maybe this is what the big problem is with most poems that we have trouble finishing, is like we just have something we don't want to admit or aren't quite sure, yeah, or we're hesitant to admit in some way. I love, Nikhyle Davis once said that poetry is like a psychological thriller that you're playing with yourself. And I just felt that with this particular exercise is like, what am I not admitting? What am I hiding from myself right now? And, you know, my poem is not about a really difficult topic either. It was like about relaxing finally and just not trying to be active and not trying to go out and make money or make objects or prove myself and my worth. But there's still fear even in that, like the fear of being called lazy and the fear of being ridiculed for like not producing and not being at work for a couple of days, even though it's a small thing. I mean, it took me a really, really long time to be able to see that that was the challenge. That was the real challenge and tension of the poem. I kept trying to like engender all of these other false tensions, like, oh, you know, night is coming on, death is going to happen. And like just reaching into these other like things that are tropes in poetry, trying to like give it attention that would make the poem more dramatic. But instead, the real tension is just, yeah, it's, I don't want to be called lazy. as we're coming on time here, I want to say thank you so much to all of those folks who donated their time to us and let us interview them and shared with us their various perspectives on poetry and their stories of their own triumphs and struggles with words. It was super enlightening. And I have to say, I gained something from everybody. I know we kind of do this, you know, what was the most helpful thing, because there's only so much time to focus on what we learned. But really, everyone's advice this session really gave me something new to chew on and kept me writing, even though there has been so much that could have potentially distracted us. So thank you to everyone who was on the Salon Cast this season.
Yes, thank you for your knowledge, for your time, for giving us mini poetry workshops through all lines of wisdom and revision exercises. So, and thank you so much to our listeners for all of the support. And please let us know if there is a poet or poetry question that you would like to hear from or about for next season.
And once again, you can friend us on Facebook, listen and subscribe, and rate us. Just remember, you can become a member of the Poetry Salon for very affordable prices. And for that, you get more access to our wonderful writing prompts that we take from other poets. Become a member of the Poetry Salon on Patreon. And I look forward to continuing to have this conversation with you, Kelly, with all of our fantastic writer friends who will be joining us in season 3.
Yay, that was fun.
Thanks to our sound editor and production manager, one-man tech department, Alan Rubenstein, for help on all things computer.
Remember, you can also check us out at thepoetrysalon.com or on the Poetry Salon's YouTube channel, where you can get access to selected poetry readings, prompts, recorded blog posts, and more.
If you want to stay in touch, ask us questions, or suggest a poet for us to interview, message us at Trisha@thepoetrysalon.com or Kelly@thepoetrysalon.com, or you can message us on our Poetry Salon Facebook page.
To help us spread the word about the Salon Cast and about poetry in general, subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also tell a friend, share this on social media, or hire a plane to write a message about us in the sky.
If you want to support our poetry community and get more support for your own writing, become a Patreon member.
That's right. For $1 a month on Patreon, we'll send you a new writing prompt with a new technique every week.
And for $5 a month, we'll give you an honest, useful, in-depth look at how we use the revision techniques we got on this podcast to rewrite our old drafts.
There is no guarantee what you'll see will be pretty
or finished
or free of typos,
but it will be honest. And you'll learn some fun new ways to get a fresh perspective on your old drafts. Until next time, Salon Cast listeners, stay creative and remember, whoever writes the worst draft wins.
Yay!